Good afternoon, good evening, good day, dear ones. Just spending a moment looking at your images or your names and feeling a sense of connection and common humanity. Here we all are together, showing up as best as we can, practicing. Practicing with all the causes and conditions that you've mentioned in the practice meetings today and yesterday, with practicing with whatever is arising for you personally, for practicing with. Interesting. I'm just getting a note that the sound is really loud. Is the sound okay for you guys? Or the sound is okay. I'm getting thumbs up from everyone. Okay, great. So it might just be that need to be turned down perhaps on your end. Person I was getting the message for. Okay, great. So yeah, just delighted seeing you and hearing how you've been practicing. Many of you have been practicing with other beings, some of you with four-legged beings in your lives, which has been so sweet. One person with a being who is about to be born in a few days, just holding you in my heart. Yes, the unborn. Just humanity is here. Humanity and a sense of warmth and care and holding all of this, the 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows, with warmth, with care, with welcoming what is, not turning away, not turning away. So, and however you've been practicing, which has been appropriate for you, practicing with metta for yourself, for a dear being. With phrases radiating, whether you've been practicing with compassion for yourself, dear being, all beings. Again, there's so many ways to practice, whether you've been practicing lying down, taking care of your body. Great. The metta retreat is a perfect place for that, or standing or walking, just however you've been. Drop by drop by drop, as Diana beautifully brought in, filling the water jug for all of humanity, not just for yourself, but for all of humanity. Moistening your own heart and your practice. Really, all of our practices in this body, in this mind, whatever the conditions, whether they're challenging or whether they're easeful. And of course, you all know that it keeps changing. It keeps changing. One moment it can be wonderful, heart of metta, and another moment could be challenging and tough and painful. And another moment could be boredom, like, oh gosh, really, do I want to sit? And another moment is elation. Oh, thank heavens that I'm doing this retreat. So all of that, rolling along with all of that and holding all of that, welcoming all of that. With metta, with friendliness, with warm-heartedness. Oh yes, hi. You too. Hi, welcome. Let's have tea, body ache. Let's have tea together. How you doing? So simply that, and we just keep cultivating, moment by moment by moment, supporting each other, supporting ourselves. So I am humbled and really touched as I look at your faces in gallery view. Thank heavens for gallery view. Just my heart is buoyed. Whatever your conditions might be, even if in the middle of right now you're hearing in the middle of a storm in this moment, you are held in the community right now. You're part of this retreat. You're being held, even if it's hard for you to hold yourself. What's coming up in your own heart? If a multiple hindrance attack is arising right now with aversions. Know that you are held. Know that you are held. This too is held. This too is held. So, so few words. I wanted to offer a few words for our practice together today to hopefully support us and and some of what I wanted to share has been inspired by what's come up really through the practice meetings, what basically you have brought up, because I feel that this retreat is a co-creation. We've offered some, you've offered, you've been practicing, so we've been co-creating this together. So I first wanted to start with the story of how this practice of metta was first taught and why it was first taught by the Buddha. Many of you have heard this story. I invite you to hear it again with a beginner's mind. Maybe it lands a little differently this time and something else might open up for you. Because as Suzuki Roshi said, the beginner's mind has lots of possibilities, but I forget what he called it, the mind who knows, the non-beginner's mind, the, I don't know, all know it, I know it all mind, is closed. It is not open to possibilities. It's kind of fixed. It's limited. It's like it's made its mind up that it knows. Whereas let's open it up and see, because we're all human beings. We're all learning. We're all learning with humility in this lifetime. So it is said, and it's quite a lovely fable, that the Buddha sent the monks to practice in a forest. As often in the suttas, forests are great places with lots of trees, sitting under trees to practice. So the monks went to the forest, and apparently, it is said, thus have I heard, that there were tree spirits in this forest who didn't want people coming in, and they just wanted to hang out with themselves, not these new monks coming and disturbing them. So they decided to scare the bejesus out of the monks with ghoulish sounds and images and visions and apparently smells too. So you can imagine it was pretty scary and pretty horrible. So it is said that the monks, terrified, they run away from the forest and they come to the Buddha saying, Buddha, please, please send us anywhere. We'll go practice anywhere diligently. Just don't send us to that forest, please. It's scary out there. And as I mentioned, one of the groups, the Buddha, he had a sense of humor. His sense of humor really comes through in many places in the suttas. In this case, he says, well, you know, I'm going to send you to a forest. I'm going to send you to the very same forest, but I will give you the only protection you will need. The only protection you will need. And him being the Buddha, the monks trusted him. And the protection he gave them was the metta practice. He gave the metta practice as protection, safety. So the monks returned with trepidation at first to the forest. And the story goes, they practiced metta. They practiced metta diligently for the tree spirits. And I trust for themselves too, because they must have been very scared. And again, the fable goes that, oh, after a while, the tree spirits actually started to take a liking to these monks who were spreading kindness, spreading goodness. They started to like them. So they started to actually care for them and protect them and feed them. And the forest became a very hospitable place for the monks. And they practiced happily ever after together with the tree spirits. So it's a happy ending story. So what I love about this story is really how it points to how metta is a form of protection from fear, really a sense of fear when fear arises, to protect us from fear, from either things that arise. So in this story, what I love about it is that the image of these tree spirits, whether it's an internal thought, an internal image of we're hearing sounds, it's our internal, may you be free from inner and outer harm, right? That's the first line of the metta phrases, the first metta. May you be safe from inner harm. Guess who causes the inner harm? We do, right? With our fears, with our thoughts, with all the things that we're causing for ourselves, inadvertently, of course, given causes and conditions that we've been subjected to, but may I be safe from inner and outer harm. It's just creating the sense of safety, offering safety to ourselves, and offering safety to others, of course, as the first line, as the base, before even we go to happy and healthy and ease and all that, safety. And the significance of this, years ago when I learned it, at first it didn't quite click for me. And in fact, some teachers switch it around and teach, may you be happy first, and may you be happy, healthy, and then safe. So I used to practice at that. And then I looked at some more canonical resources, and it pointed to safety being first. So I thought, hey, let me practice it that way and see what happens if I practice it that way. And again, there's no wrong. If it works for you to say happy first, it's all good. There's no right or wrong. These are all skillful means. But I'm just sharing from my practice what I discovered. So when I switched it around and really brought emphasis to safety being first, whoa. There was this realization how that is so important for my heart to feel safe, to feel, yes, it can land. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's safe. And then the other wishes landed better for me, the happiness and health. Because until you feel safety, it's hard to feel happy. It's hard to feel healthy, hard to have ease, etc. And sense of safety is so fundamental and basic. This offering that, and there are various, in psychology, for example, the Bowlby theory of development and child development, the sense of attachment, safe attachment theory, the sense of safety for children, the safety of attachment, feeling safe. Feeling safe is so important, fundamental. Everything else gets kind of layered on top of that sense of the child feeling safe enough that then, oh yeah, mommy's here. I can go and wander and explore the world. And no, I can come back and mommy will still be here. There's a sense of safety. So as human beings, sense of safety being so important. So in way of offering ourselves safety and offering others safety by making ourselves safe for other people so they don't have to be scared of us. And one can say that practicing the Dharma can be viewed as making ourselves safe for others, making ourselves a refuge for others, offering safety. And practice of metta is a wonderful way of doing that, offering ourselves safety, filling our own cup with a sense of safety, and extending it to others. Hey, I'm safe. May you be well. I don't want to harm you. I'm friendly. May you be well. May you be well. And And having said that, another thing that arises and has arisen in the practice meetings, and it arises when one practices metta, that, oh, now if I practice metta, offering myself safety and offering others safety, does it mean that I'm going to become a doormat? Do I become a wet noodle and people can walk all over me? I'm scared of practicing. Or would I become a couch potato? And if I practice self-compassion and oh, it's all okay, I don't have to accomplish anything, it's all right. So I want to address those two a little separately, actually. So with regards to becoming a doormat, it's not, that's not the intention, and that's not the goal, and that's not the fruit of the metta practice at all. So the idea is there's a sense of compassion. Actually, I'm going to use the word compassion for a moment, both for metta. Let's say metta, because it's the central one. Metta and compassion, I'll use them interchangeably just for a moment. Metta, compassion, and wisdom, they go together. They really go together. And one without the other is doesn't work. So if you only practice wisdom practices, insight practices, arising, passing, without any kindness, any sense of receptivity, friendliness, warmth, any openness of heart. Let's just say openness of heart. The stance of openness of heart. If the wisdom is dry, is very dry, one gets into trouble. One really gets into trouble as stages, various stages start to unfold. It becomes really dry and really hard. And actually one simile that I like, Joseph Goldstein uses, he says that insight without that wisdom without compassion, wisdom without metta, is like riding a bicycle that has no air in its tires. It's a really bumpy, rough ride. You don't get there very easily. It's just bumpy and hard. You're cycling, like you're trying wisdom, but there is no gentleness. There is no metta, warm-heartedness, care. Again, there's so many different ways to see the sense of metta to help you move forward. And now, metta without wisdom, or compassion without wisdom, all the Brahma Viharas without wisdom, that doesn't work either. That the Tibetans have a great term that I'm going to borrow. The term they have is idiot compassion. So wisdom, if you don't have any wisdom in your compassion practice, it's idiot compassion. And that's the sense of, oh yeah, walk all over me. Oh child, oh, darling child, you want to have a second bucket of ice cream? Oh, I love you. Yeah, sure. Have a second full bucket of ice. I mean, that's not really love and compassion, right? There's no wisdom in it. There's no wisdom in that. So wisdom knows what's appropriate so that metta, compassion doesn't become enabling. It doesn't become enabling inappropriateness or harm from another person, or even harm from ourselves. The wisdom always needs to be there. And also, the sense of, excuse me, my mouth is running dry. And with, you know, again, with wisdom, with compassion or metta, not having wisdom at all, It doesn't express it. It's not the full expression of metta. It's not the full expression of compassion if it doesn't have the sense of wisdom in it. And sometimes, for example, we might need to show up with what's called fierce compassion or fierce metta. And that too is compassionate, is loving, both towards ourselves or another. So, for example, if another person is being harmful, we're not going to just say, oh, yeah, it's fine, it's okay. They say, no, this is not appropriate. This is not appropriate. Stop. And doing that, though, it's not coming out of hatred for the other person. That's the difference. It's not coming out of hatred for the other person. It's coming out of love for ourselves and love and consideration for everyone's well-being. So it's not coming out of hatred, but it's stopping the harm, making space between yourself and who's harming you. Not throwing anyone out of your heart, even if they may not be in your life anymore. It's something that I think Sharon Salzberg says it when asked. He says, don't throw anyone out of your heart, even if you throw them out of your life. I think it's Sharon. I believe it's Sharon. Anyway, I might be misattributing. It's either Sharon or it's Sylvia Boorstein, one or the other Metta Queens. So the idea here being that not out of ill will, really out of care, compassion for everyone, and yet you protect yourself. You protect yourself out of compassion for yourself, out of care for yourself. You bring in wisdom. And there is this famous story that I'd like to relate also, since I brought her name in, Sharon Salzberg. When she was in India, there's this story in her book, I think the most often told story, that she was going to see her teacher, Munindraji. And she's on a rickshaw, and a drunken person somehow manages in an alley to try to pull her down from the rickshaw. And she's very scared as to, the whole situation. And the driver of the rickshaw manages to get them free. And anyway, making it to visit her teacher, she's shaken, scared, and tells the story to Munindraji. And Munindraji says, well, Sharon, with with all the love in your heart, you should have taken your umbrella and hit the drunken person over the head. So the idea here is that with all the love in your heart, it's not out of hatred for the drunken person. They're causing harm. They don't even know. It's out of ignorance, out of not knowing any better. In this moment, they're causing harm to themselves. They're causing harm to you. They're causing harm to everyone. So it's wise to stop it, to say no. But it's not out of ill will. It's out of love. It's out of compassion. So it's really important to keep that in mind as you're practicing metta for yourself, compassion for yourself and for others, how wisdom really comes into it. It doesn't mean to make yourself a punching bag for anyone to walk over you. No, there's a sense of actually uprightness and strength. The Buddha, having been the paragon of compassion and metta and wisdom, there's a sense of integrity. And as you read his words, there is a sense of integrity. He's many times he's kind of like a fierce compassion comes through in his teachings. It's compassionate, loving, not harmful, but yet it's sitting tall, sitting aligned. Nope. It's beaming compassion for others and himself, and yet it's not it's certainly anything but a punching bag. So So I wanted to offer that as a way of, how would metta affect me? Oh, practicing this, continuing to. And then another concern that has come up in terms of self-compassion, and I loved Diana talking about the various challenges with self-compassion and also with compassion about, sometimes trying to push things away, with metta trying to push things away, and what gets in the way of self-compassion with the judging mind, etc. And one thing I'd like to bring in is actually what came in the practice meeting, I think it was today, was this sense that actually there are some research studies that suggest that those who are more compassionate to themselves actually take more responsibility instead of taking less responsibility. And very briefly, there were these couple of studies where different scenarios, but basically, people were either subjects were either led to. You see, actually, if I have the details of it in front of me, instead of just remembering from memory. Yeah, right. So yeah, the couple of studies. One is by Julian Brines and Serena Chen from UC Berkeley, where they had 100 undergraduates think about a recent moral transgression that they regretted and felt guilty about. And they had a group of participants who were told to write something kind and understanding about what happened. That's the compassion group. And then another group that was told to just think about their positive qualities, and the third group that was told to write about their favorite hobbies. So really a control group, the other two. So in this study, the group that was instructed to be self-compassionate was significantly more motivated to repair any harm that was caused by the transgression. And they committed not to repeat the mistake again, more than the other two groups. And similarly, another study by Mark Leary and colleagues, they found that when, again, people, participants were instructed to be self-compassionate when thinking about a past mistake, humiliation, they were much more likely, actually, not less likely, to accept personal responsibility for what happened, rather than blaming it on others, on outside people or events. And apparently, a few other studies also that show that people are more likely to feel a sense of remorse and a desire to make amends than shame if they are more compassionate. So this makes sense, right? Because if there is a sense of metta or compassion towards ourselves, then there is a gentleness. Then when you realize, when you think about something that went wrong, a mistake you did, then there is capacity, there is warmth, there's spaciousness. Oh, sweetie, yes, that wasn't so great, but it's okay. It's okay. We'll make amends. I still love you. You're still a good person. But if there isn't any of that, if there's harshness, if there is so much self-judgment about oneself, there is no capacity in one's heart to admit any mistakes. If you admit any mistakes, then you're a horrible person and you're awful, and there's no space to admit anything. So does that make sense? So when there is a sense of self-compassion, yes, you can still admit that, yes, something went wrong, and it's okay. You'll make amends. Whereas when there isn't any, then it's much easier to blame others for what went wrong. Does that make sense? The logic of this? Nod your head if it makes sense. If not, I'll try to explain further. Okay. So in this way, self-compassion actually makes us take more responsibility. Because if there was no self-compassion, then we'd be beating ourselves up so hard that would be down under the bushes, be totally beat up by ourselves, can't even get up for the second round. It's so painful. We'll be depressed for days, right? But whereas the self-compassion is, sweetie, yeah, that was, yeah, okay. Let's not do that again. That's, yeah. It there's a sense of acceptance and repair that could be done instead of throwing perfectly good future moments after challenging moments of the past. So a couple words on that. And yeah. So I wanted to also say a couple of things about self, excuse me, about actually about the Brahma Viharas, about how they are practiced, as I mentioned during the first day, you know, the four Brahma Viharas, the four heavenly abodes, these four practices. The first one being, the central one being metta, loving kindness, warmth, goodwill, love, which really is the sense of warm-heartedness that meets a being that is in a neutral situation, neutral condition. Now, if the same metta meets someone who's suffering, then metta becomes compassion. And I love what Diana was saying, that compassion is the love child of metta and suffering. I love that. I hadn't heard that before. It's beautiful. So this metta, this warm-heartedness meeting one who's suffering gets expressed as compassion. And as you've heard, there's slightly different tone, quality to practicing metta than practicing compassion. The phrases are a little different in order to acknowledge the suffering that's happening. And when this metta, when this warm-heartedness again meets someone who's doing really well, really well. They're just, yay. They always wanted to say something and now they have it, or they're doing well. Oh, may your happiness continue. May it never wane. May it never cease. It gets expressed as mudita, as vicarious joy externally. And now, if that person we're wishing well, that the person we're happy for their happiness happens to be ourselves, then this practice, this third Brahma Vihara becomes, guess what? Gratitude. So gratitude is actually part of the Brahma Vihara. It's kind of snuck in there, hidden in mudita. When our goodwill, our warmth, our care meets our own good fortune. Ah, I am so happy for my own good fortune. May it increase, may it never end. And soon enough, you'll realize you're practicing gratitude. I am so grateful for my good fortune. That's how it becomes. That's how it naturally will express itself. And again, as mentioned, upekkha is both what supports all of these, all the other Brahma Viharas as their base, as their foundation. And it's also another way, so that the Brahma Viharas don't tip into their opposites, they don't become clingy, they don't fall into their far or near enemies. And I'll speak about that in a moment because I think it'll be helpful. So upekkha equanimity both serves as this foundation that you're sitting on when practicing these other Brahma Viharas. It can also be thought as, you know, sometimes when it's just a sense of overwhelm or the suffering is so much that it can be met, it can be better be held by equanimity. So there are two different ways to see equanimity in the Brahma Viharas. Of course, there are other equanimities in the seven factors of awakening, et cetera, et cetera. But not going there, another retreat. So here, equanimity as this base that we're really sitting on and practicing, so that these Brahma Viharas don't veer into their far and near enemies. So I think it's helpful to name the near and far enemies. This is the classical Buddhist language, just in case we recognize them in our practice. And you know, far and near enemies, kind of a funny wording. I still like it. I think I have fondness for it. Perhaps the more updated would be the near enemy would be the masquerader, something that masquerades as the real thing, but it's not quite the real thing, and the far enemy as the opposite. It's just the opposite. So with metta, the masquerader, aka near enemy, is attachment. And again, if any of these arise in your practice, don't worry, it's okay. It needs to come out, needs to be purified. As a side note, metta is also a purification practice. What does that mean? Feelings, emotions, they come up. They do come up. They get purified. Grief can come up, sadness, various things that are not quite processed. They do come up. An argument you had with your best friend, with your loved one 10 years ago, which you haven't thought about in 10 years, can come up. And here you are sitting on this retreat trying to cultivate metta. And here's anger. You're so angry about this thing they did. Never returned that phone call. So it's okay. It's okay. It's a purification practice. It's a purification. Trust it. Being with it. Being with yourself with compassion, with what's coming out with metta, or maybe with equanimity as it's needed. This too, it's like this. So back from the footnote, but to say it's all okay, whatever arises, just as long as you're kind with it, with yourself. So the masquerader of metta, loving kindness, being attachment to outcome, attachment, I guess for all of these, the attachment to outcome is an enemy, is a dear enemy, is a masquerader. So in this particular way, the attachment can come up that may you be happy. I really want you to be happy. Are you happy yet? Or I really want myself to be happy. I want this pain. May you be happy. Are you gone yet? You know, in a way similar to what Diana was talking about yesterday. It's like trying to do metta to push it away, like through happiness. Like you really want your body to be happy, or you really want yourself to be happy, instead of cultivating the heart. Yeah, it's without attachment to outcome, without attachment to outcome, just offering these wishes to yourself, to others. May you be happy. May you be safe, without any attachment to outcome that you would actually will be or will not be. Without any magical thinking, metta is different here. Say from prayer, there's some similarities and some differences, that here there's no attachment to outcomes, just offering it, putting it out in the universe, just putting it out, cultivating your own heart, and as a free gift, as a free offering, instead of, well, kind of, you know, expect outcome, you know, results now, where is it? Hey, universe. It's just offering it with generosity, putting it out, cultivating your heart. Another way this can show up, this attachment, is attachment to the being you're giving this the metta to, that it's kind of conditional. I wish you happiness and wellness and all the good, so that you like me, so that you love me, so that You'll return it in kind. I'll only love you if you love me. There's another kind of conditionality. And again, if these arise, just see them, recognize them. Oh, sweetie, it's okay. It's all right. Yeah, I see attachment. It's okay. Just see them. Just see them. It's natural for all of these things to arise and to be seen and to be purified. There are no mistakes. I'm letting you know they arise just to recognize them. So, whereas metta, really the practice of metta, in its pure form, is just a sense of open-heartedness. May you be one without any expectations, without any attachment to you or the outcome. Now, the opposite, also known as the far enemy of metta, is ill will. That one's easy. Right? Metta, warmth, kindness, the opposite is just ill will. Ah, may you not be happy, may you Stop. Fill in the blanks, right? So that's opposite. I think that's kind of easy to recognize, the opposite when it comes up. And again, if it comes up in the form of anger or ill will, again, oh dear, this is really hard. Yeah, because who's the one who's hurting, actually? Who's the one who's really in pain when we have ill will about somebody else? It's us. Of course, it's us. So, self-compassion and compassion, which leads us into the second of the fabulous four, Fab Four. Maybe we should call the Brahma Viharas the Fab Four. So the second one being compassion. So compassion, the masqueraders, has a few masqueraders. The masquerader, near enemy, is one is pity. One is pity. Compassion is not pity. So if you find yourself falling into pity when you're practicing self-compassion, oh, poor me. Oh, poor me. If nobody else has this kind of a problem anywhere in the world, never, no one ever has, no one will, poor me. Ooh, maybe it's falling into pity. Or if you're feeling that for others, oh, poor you. Oh, may you be free from the suffering. But, oh, poor you. Something like this would never happen to me. It's just you. It's your bad luck. Realize maybe it has veered into it's a masquerader of compassion. Just recognizing it. Sometimes these masqueraders, they kind of come out and do 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 do. They rear their heads when we don't expect them. So with pity, perhaps one way to recognize what's underneath is the sense of comparison, is the comparing mind, is if you're doing it for others, oh, I'm here, I'm giving you compassion. Oh, you poor thing suffering, I'm up here and my high horse, and may you be free from this thing. Whereas realizing, just like me, this could be me. This could have been me. This could be me in the future. This could have been me in the past. There's nothing fundamentally different between you and any other human being in this world. It's so random whom you've ended up being, whom your parents have ended up being, your nationality, your race, your color, your capacities, capabilities, it's all so random. Really, if we could have been born as each other, it's boggling. We're not given a menu to choose from. It's just here you are. You find yourself in, oh yeah, okay, all right, here we go. This is life, right? It's so random. So with that perspective, it could have been me. It is me what's happening to you. May you be well. May you be free from this, dear one, as if it were me. And similarly, reversed, just like everyone else. This pain or sorrow, this difficulty I'm going through, you know, you're practicing compassion. Many other people in the world have gone through this or are going through this or will go through some version of this. It's just like me, just like me. So one really profound practice here is to, when you're doing self-compassion for yourself, to imagine other beings in the world, imagine them, imagine different people, different countries, different nationalities, races, languages, backgrounds, ages, sizes, whatever, make it as diverse, that they're in some way, they have the same, they're suffering in the same way you are, and wish them well and wish yourself well. May all of us suffering in this way, all of us suffering in this way, may all of us be free. May all of us have ease. May all of us have grace through this difficulty. Just like me, just like me, just like me. And this practice in particular that I just highlighted, and I think I recently did a happy hour on Audio Dharma. It's available on this. I think the title of it might be Perspectives 1 or 2 or 3 or something. You can find it. This was my go-to practice years ago when I was really sick. I was homebound and bedbound. And I imagined people around the world. I imagined as I was lying in bed and couldn't move, like, oh yeah, there's this man in, I don't know, in Northern Europe who's in a hospital bed, and how must be a feel for them? They're bedbound too. Oh, just like me, dear one, may you be free. May you have peace. Or there's a woman in a hut in Africa. Oh, sister, just like me, you understand how hard this is for both of us. May you be well. So not feeling alone in our suffering. There's 7 billion people in this world. There's so many circumstances. So common humanity can be so powerful when wishing all of these beings freedom from suffering, along with yourself, all of us, this tribe that's suffering in this way. And really, they get it. It's the support group. It's a, you know, the same way that we're practicing this Zoom or different places in the world. Well, and we're not together in one place. They're the same way people are suffering in the same way, separate places. In my mind, I bring them into a Zoom room together. May all of us be well. So pity being a near enemy or being a masquerader. Another masquerader, as it's been mentioned, and it bears repeating, in this context, is empathic distress. Empathic distress. It's also called compassion fatigue, but there is no such a thing as compassion fatigue if you define compassion to be the meeting of warm-heartedness, metta, well-being, kindness, and suffering. It's really empathy fatigue, as Diana was saying. It's really empathy fatigue. So empathy really, and there's some neuroscience studies to support this. You know, empathy being one part of compassion, there are two parts. Empathy is when you feel the suffering of another. Empathy is when your mirror neurons, if we wanted to just for a moment get in a neuroscientific centric again, with a limited view of our whole being, but just for one moment, allow me, is where your mirror neurons are feeling, are resonating, or you see another person's hand stabbed, you know, if you're a subject in one of the studies and you see the hand being stabbed or poked, and the areas in your brain that feel pain for you those areas light up. So you literally are feeling somebody else's pain. That's the empathy. You're literally resonating with someone else's pain. That's the empathy part. So if you just did that, if you just resonated with somebody else's pain, that would be very painful, right? That would be excruciating if you did that all day, sitting, sort of practicing compassion. If you practiced just empathy, ouch. In fact, there's a little story. I'll tell this story. This is years ago. I was at the Mind and Life Institute meeting, and Tanya Singer, who's a well-known researcher, a neuroscientist, was telling the story of how she had, oh gosh, I'm going to blank on his name. The name will come to me. Yes, Matthieu Ricard. She had Matthieu Ricard, who's this well-known monk who's practiced compassion and just a really renowned monk in the Tibetan tradition, studying his brain. So put them in the fMRI machine and told them, okay, don't practice compassion, just practice empathy, just feeling people's pain, just this one part, right? So they flashed all these images of suffering and told them, don't practice compassion, which is the full thing. Just practice resonating with people's pain. So he does that. They realize, yep, this is the only part, the area of the brain that lights up and with when we feel really literally feel somebody else's pain. You feel pain. So then they bring him out and he says, can you please put me back? I feel terrible. It's just, I feel really pained. Can I please practice the full compassion now? So they put him back and, same practice, same images, but now he can practice full compassion, both resonating with the suffering, holding that, but now holding it with warmth, with care, with love. And another area of the brain also lights up, which has to do with filial emotions, with warmth, with care, with love. So that lights up. And they bring him up and out and says, okay, I feel good. It's okay. It's the sense of cleansing. So to say that one alone, just feeling someone's pain, resonating with pain, of course, is painful, is distressing. But really, both together is a practice of compassion. And in that way, practicing compassion for ourselves and for others actually feels good. That's why it's a Brahma Vihara. That's why it's one of the heavenly abodes, because it feels good. It's not supposed to feel icky or painful. Your heart feels expansive, offering its response, holding compassion. So please notice if compassion practice is feeling kind of painful and tight, maybe a little more warmth and care and metta is needed to hold the compassion. So let that be your guide. Otherwise, when you're practicing compassion, it feels so good. Hence, these practices, these Brahma Viharas, also being a practice, they can be practiced as concentration practices, as samatha practice, samadhi practices, concentration practices leading to absorption states of jhana, which are blissful and lovely and happy and full. So I offer that not to bring up any grasping, please let that go, but just to get a sense that, hey, this compassion, when it's kind of clear and has you have the antenna kind of such that there's enough kindness holding the suffering, it actually feels good so much so that this opening of the heart is possible. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible if it was a painful, awful, challenging thing. So let that kind of be your guide. Oh yeah, a little more care, a little more warmth needed is to hear to hold the suffering here. So, yeah, just to wrap up those thoughts, and I mentioned pity, and I mentioned empathic distress, sympathetic distress, also called overwhelm, also could be anguish or grief, any of those would be when there's empathy alone. And the far enemy or the opposite is pretty clear in a way. It's there are two of them. I have one. One is cruelty, opposite of compassion. And again, that's pretty clear to recognize. And the other one is Schadenfreude, happiness at somebody else's misfortune, which again is pretty easy to recognize, as to put it out there. Just a couple of minutes left. I feel like I just for completion, I'll just mention briefly the near and far enemies of the two other Brahma Viharas, just for completion. Otherwise, you're hanging by the edge of your seat, way or by the other two. So with mudita, the near enemy, multiple ones, but one of them is a sense of pride, like, ah, my child, my team, oh, they won, me, mine, which is that attachment that we talked about showing up in this way. Another way you can show up is also could show up as exuberance, that we get so happy on somebody else's happiness that just we're bouncing off the walls, and which is kind of fun, but it doesn't have the balance of equanimity to kind of ground it and balance it. You still it's happy, but it's not too bouncing off the walls. And then the opposite of it again is easy to detect, to see is envy. When you're feeling happy for somebody else's good fortune, then falling into envy. Why do you have that? I want to have that. So kind of the opposite. And then with equanimity, the near enemy, the masquerader, is aloofness, is kind of this coldness of pulling back. Oh, I don't care. Yeah, it's all okay, whatever. Whereas equanimity really has a sense of warmth, presence. It holds presence, cares enough to be present. And the opposite of equanimity is falling into it. It's either greed, really wanting things to be a particular way, or pushing away, or aversion, really pushing things to be away. Because equanimity is equipoise, holding things just as is, neither pushing away nor grasping. So the opposite is pretty easy to tell. So, plenty more dharma, plenty more time in our hearts to explore. And now it's 5:15, right on the dot. So let's just sit together for a few seconds and let the words, ooh, fill the jug. May we all cultivate drop by drop, moment by moment, this gift that we give to ourselves and to the whole world, the cultivation of goodness. In any way possible. Thank you all for your kind attention.